The article itself begins by outlining sort of a timeline starting in 2008, having to do with the way that the federal government at the time was sort of responding to criticism about possible environmental complications for various waterways, including the Athabasca River, pollutants that were directly tied to oil and gas production. Can you just explain a little bit about what your concern was with the environmental effects from tar sands production and what the government's response at the time was?
All right. I think the problem really goes back to the provincial government of Alberta, which was putting out that the oil sands were not affecting the Athabasca River at all. And I did not feel that that could be correct. For one, they were not measuring the input of airborne pollutants into the river. In 1981 already, I had chaired a U.S. National Academy panel that examined the pollutant output from smelting and burning fossil fuels, and we did not find a single case where there was not airborne pollutants. And in the tar sands, they're smelting this bitumen, which has both organic and inorganic pollutants in large quantities. The industry was reporting that it had high emissions of things like mercury and arsenic and so on, but the government claimed that they weren't getting into the river. In fact, they weren't measuring them at all. And similarly, they claimed that digging up the watershed was putting nothing into the Athabasca River or its tributaries. Based on a program known as the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program, which was run by industry, and I knew that the RAMP program had had a scathing independent review in late 2004, and indeed after our 2008 study, it received yet another one from an independent group. So I challenged the claim that the tar sands were not polluting the river, the tar sands industry, that is. And the minister assured me that everything was just fine. So a group of us decided to mount our own study and to test the airborne pollutant hypothesis. We sampled snow at the end of winter when there would be about 4 months of accumulation of fallout in the snow, and found, as we expected, that there was considerable fallout of all of the pollutants that were in the tar sands, detectable out to a radius of 50 kilometers. And similarly, we looked at the pollutants in the river, both in late winter and again in midsummer, and found that pollutants were always higher downstream of industry. They were higher downstream of the industry than they were downstream of natural formations, which is what the industries and government wanted people to believe, that it was all natural. And we published those results in two papers in the Proceedings of the U.S. National Academy, which is a journal that takes good color images, which made it a convenient place to publish. And the first thing that happened was denial by both the provincial and federal ministers of environment. Fortunately, the federal minister had second thoughts and decided to fly out to Edmonton for a personal briefing. And after we went through and discussed our results with him, he was obviously fairly convinced and said, "What should I do?" And I said, "Well, rather than let this all be my opinion or my group's opinion versus the rest, why don't you put it out to an eminent group of scientists for review?" So he formed a panel of members of the Royal Society, ranging from ecologists to petroleum geologists, gave them 2 months, And they came back and said, yes, indeed, we were right that the monitoring program that they had been relying on was fatally flawed, and that our results indicated that it needed a great improvement. Shortly after he had formed his panel, the province formed their own panel, equally good experts. They gave them 4 months instead of two and gave them the task of comparing our data directly to the government's. And again, they found the government's data were wanting. In one case, they told them that a report that they kept pointing to had never been properly designed to measure the impact of the industry on the Athabasca River. And again, they said that we had uncovered some very important deficiencies in the program that needed correcting. So that was the situation as of early 2011. At that point, the then minister said, well, it's obvious we need some change. I'll appoint a panel of experts to help design a world-class monitoring program. So he did, and they reported in July. That panel was about half scientists and about half business people, but their report surprised the minister, I think, in that it said that a new monitoring program should be run by a panel of independent experts, not by either level of government, because both federal and provincial levels of government had lost the public trust. And the minister promised to act on that, but then we had an election. We got a new premier. The previous minister lost his job. It took a while for the new minister to learn her portfolio. But in February, after meeting with myself and also some of the people who were on that world-class monitoring panel, she appointed a panel to help flesh out what she had been told by the world-class monitoring program. They reported the end of June of this year. The minister finally acted on it about a week ago, and reportedly she had a tremendous fight to sell it to her caucus, but a week ago she announced that it would be independent, appointed some people to the initial board of it with the mandate to make recommendations on funding it and on scientific oversight for the panel and on Aboriginal input to the panel. So that's where it stands right now. That recently appointed panel has indicated that they're going to act very rapidly. So perhaps now, going on 4 years after our studies were done, we have a glimmer of hope that perhaps we'll have a monitoring program for the Athabasca that could actually detect what's going on.
And now that's that gives us a fairly good story of sort of the last several years, and especially during rapid expansion in the Alberta tar sands sort of project. It brings up a wide number of questions here. I'm not entirely sure where to start. I think the place that I'd like to start, however, though, is, I mean, you, among other things, have been quite an outspoken for a scientist, the kind of original science activist and a personal hero of mine, Carl Sagan. One of the things that he experienced, and something that I've seen many other scientists, you're certainly not the only scientist or group of scientists that have been looking at health and environmental effects from Alberta energy projects, has been that under a number of cases, their work has been attacked. There have been direct personal attacks against scientists who have spoken out. What has been your experience just having been an outspoken scientist and this sort of fight to even get, you know, like you outlined in the article a number of times how, you know, the studies that were in place or the checks that were in place were not valid. And if someone with knowledge had sort of gone over them or designed them, that they, you know, they wouldn't have obviously had these flaws. Just about the genuine attitude of either the federal or the provincial government to even have science involved at all in the decision-making process?
I came here from the U.S. Originally in the 1960s because Canada was a world leader in that sort of thing. And the governments of the day, if they saw something that was going wrong environmentally, they wanted to fix it. They, in the 60s, put together a number of new big scientific institutions. I found that in those days, if you did the science to recommend a fix, politicians received it gladly and passed the necessary policy to see that it happened. The best example being controls on nutrients that caused eutrophication, the algal blooms on lakes. And we were able to fix Lakes Erie in Ontario and a lot of smaller lakes in Canada, and those policies were copied around the world. But things slowly deteriorated. In the days of acid rain, at first there was denial that acid rain happened. In one case, I was accused of inventing the problem to keep my project alive. But events went on, largely in the U.S. and Scandinavia, that showed that it was indeed a problem. Industry, once they saw the handwriting on the wall, reacted very rapidly. And government did their best to keep up. The government requirements were always running a little bit behind industry's cuts in that case, which was rather amusing, but still the reaction was pretty rapid, and we had the most stringent acid rain policies anywhere in the world in very short order. After that, things started to run down. Department of Fisheries and Department of Environment, every time there was a budget shortfall, which was frequent, their resources were cut. And salaries fell behind universities so that they weren't able to recruit the best scientists generally, though there were a few exceptions. And things deteriorated over the years, reaching their worst at the present when the few remaining good scientists are totally muzzled. They're not allowed to speak out on matters that they know about. Everything is directed through political spin doctors who, in general, know nothing about anything and are inclined to put out press releases that are meaningless, that contain no real information. And in a so-called democracy, and having been taught that a functional democracy depends on its citizens getting accurate information, I just find the whole situation right now to be detestable.
So what is, David, what is your sort of opinion or on the effect that's had? I mean, you cited acid rain there. Another example would be ozone depleting aerosols and that type of thing, where there has been a initially doubted or initially not taken seriously, but then later, you know, demonstrated to be true and taken very seriously environmental concern in Canada and all over the world. Where these issues have been dealt with, and now it seems like more recently, very similar situations having to do with various forms of pollutants from the actual mining of carbon products or climate change or any one of these other issues, there doesn't seem to be that reaction. It seems to be that the reaction is to sort of ignore the science or silence the scientists. What, in your opinion, is the difference? Where have we had this change in effect? Is this a pure cost issue, or why do you think this has happened?
We've come more and more to have politicians who worship one god, economy. And in their view, anything else is expendable as long as economy is happy. The problem is nobody knows what makes economy is happy. So we sacrifice one thing and then we sacrifice something else, all to try and make economy happy. In fact, I think John Kenneth Galbraith had it right. Economy as a science makes astrology look pretty respectable. So we're really sacrificing a lot of things that Canadians, and not only Canadians, but world citizens, view as important in order to keep economy perking along, or trying to keep it perking along, though to me it looks very much like it's on permanent life support.
There's so much that we could talk about in these issues, but very, thank you so much for joining us today, David. I know you've got a plane to hop on. Just, I've got one final question for you. Looking forward now from this place, you've got over, you know, more than 40 years experience working in Canada. It's pretty much all your life as a scientist. Do you have any words of wisdom for scientists in Canada who are concerned with the environment, but are maybe, you know, doubtful? Maybe there's students who are not even sure they want to get into the sciences because, you know, they sort of see potentially the only place to get a good job where they can do anything is to go and work for the oil industry, or go and work for, you know, research and development for a manufacturer, but not really doing, you know, the sort of research that helps us make good choices about policy, or interest-based science, sort of directionless science, where we've gotten many of the major advances of the modern age, you know, who maybe you're considering, you know, maybe either brain drain and, you know, getting pulled down to the U.S. to do research, or over to Europe to do research, or maybe considering avoiding science altogether because of this almost a sort of attack on the scientific point of view at all, as if it was just one way of looking at things. Do you have any words of wisdom or encouragement, or perhaps resignation on that issue before we go?
I would say that science is going to come back. We're in about to the same period in environmental science right now as physics was in the McCarthy era in the U.S. And I hope it'll pass very quickly. I think as a society, will realize within a few years that environmental scientists have been right. Right now, we seem to have the kinds of doubt that the tobacco industry created about cigarette smoking in the 60s and 70s, but science always prevails. We not only need scientists, we need other educated people. We need a new economics. It's clear the economics cannot continue to be the economics of growth when science shows us that we're already beyond the Earth's carrying capacity. And even countries like Canada, which is a country, is not, look like they want to move in that same direction by emulating their heroes, the U.S. and China. We need some big social changes as well, and ethical changes. There's going to be a huge debate about how we get the population back in sync with the Earth's resources. And it isn't going to be through continued economic growth. It isn't going to be through simply adopting renewable energy sources, because I don't know of a renewable energy source that does not require fossil fuels to build it and operate it. So we're going to have to look for other things that make us happy besides a pile of little rectangles with dead politicians' faces on them. And we're going to have to go through some very rough times. But the alternative is that we as a society show no more sense than a population of fruit flies.
Perhaps a place to leave it off then is promoting scientific literacy, not even necessarily in the sense of educating people in science, but perhaps we're so far gone at this point that even just a campaign to get people to sort of be scientifically literate enough to know when points of view that are being presented in the media or by politicians is even supported by facts or not, and that those facts matter, and that those generally, more often than not, those facts come from scientists, and that we need to respect and revere our scientists, not, you know, shun them when they don't agree with our personal pet issues.
I think that's very well put.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, that was David Schindler. Among many other things, 40 years of environmental science under his belt, officer of the Order of Canada, recipient of many awards, and now a Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
You're welcome.